Thank you, Brother Howard, for that thought, a devotional. He left us with the challenge of what are you going to do for Christ this week? And that's a good springboard into our message this morning. So as we've gathered in God's classroom today, what have you been learning? Did you learn anything? What will you do with the teaching that you've been under, what you've learned, what you will learn? Not because of what I say, but I pray that as the message is done, as we go home, you can forget who even preached it, but you have some nugget of truth to take along with you home. Because you know the seriousness about it is as we gather in God's classroom, there is something different than anything else, and that is when you and I leave, what did that song we say? We just got done singing? Thank you, Vera, for that selection. It talked about holding us accountable. And that's exactly what God will do. We will leave here and we'll be more accountable than what we were when we came. And we can say, oh, I don't want to come then. Well, guess what? You made a decision to go against truth. Because each of us, no matter where a person is in life, will be exposed to truth at some point, whenever. Because John 1 talks about that, about Jesus being the true light that does what? Lights every man. And so every man has an opportunity at some point. God orchestrates the events and brings him to a precipice and says, now you will need to make a choice. And so, we're at a place of decision again. What will I do with what I hear? Not because of what I have to say, but what God has to say. And James has some words about that. He says, you know, I can be a hearer, but what happens with it? Does it become a part of my life? And so as I think back, there's especially the last two sermons. Now, I wasn't here last Sunday, but I did listen to Howard's sermon. Almost all of it. Ran out of time to get all the way through it. By the way, what was this sermon anyway? It's time for a classroom review. Does anybody, if you don't remember the title, what was the thrust behind the sermon last Sunday? Bitterness. And that had to do with relationships as well, right? Exactly. So we're going to go back a little bit farther. Can anybody tell me what the message was on 2 weeks ago? Now, some of you probably weren't here. You see, we are forgetful people, right? So quickly, things just slip away. Well, the Sunday before was on walking as children of God. And you know, we listen to good messages, and we at the end of them we say, wow, that was a good message. And maybe you came this morning and you're like, yeah, well, you know, it's time to go to church. And I sit here and my eyes gloss over and I really pay no attention, and whew, you know, that's about 5 till. That preacher better get wrapped up quick. You know what? It's 11 o'clock. Why isn't he getting wound down? It's 5 after. It's time to stop. And after church, you shake his hand and, yeah, good message, brother. Walk out the door and you live life exactly the way you have been for the last 6 days. Is that Christianity? Is that Christianity? I suggest to you, it is not. It is allowing God's word to come into my life and to change me. And I will, you know, we're all projects. We're all projects. I might be the biggest one up here. God decided, you know, it's time for Thomas to go up there and I'm going to make a public demonstration of him. I don't know. But our message this morning is a pretty practical one. And that's the one that sometimes causes us to maybe shrink back just a little bit because of being practical. Because I have family here. I have coworkers here. They know exactly who Thomas is, right? But there's challenges. I mean, there's things that I want to grow in. And thinking back to the sermon 2 weeks ago, and as walking as children of God, Don run out that as children we are to do what? Walk in the light, walk in love, walk circumspectly, soberly. Howard last Sunday talked about, you know, the self-talk that we have in our hearts affects us. How other people perceive, what we think other people perceive of us. How does that all fit in? What does this produce? And thinking about walking with God, Don laid a very good foundation, and I just take it and put it into practical form. And so you may leave here and say, well, I don't quite agree with him on that. And that's okay. But I'd like for us to think a little bit, because I think we are facing as Christian people, we are facing a real pressure because of the media that's around us and the influence that it has on us. We can look up anybody and say, well, look, he's a Christian. We need to stop and think that where God has placed you is different than where God has placed him and his walk and his journey and his Christian life. And so often we want to kind of maybe stray that way. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 5. One question you could ask is, who preached the most powerful sermon? Or maybe who gave the most passionate speech? And you can think back over history, and we can think of people who have given passionate speeches, you know, trying to arouse people to action. Some were successful. Some maybe not so much. I suggest to you this morning that each one sitting here is able to preach a sermon of equal power than I can or the brother or sister sitting beside you, and we'll look into and I'll explain. Matthew chapter 5 is a Sermon on the Mount, a powerful sermon by Jesus himself. Just think with me. Matthew chapter 5 through 7 is called the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus gives his sermon on a hillside near Capernaum. And Jesus is clear. His clear teaching on what matters is faithful obedience to Christ. And where from? The heart. And this sermon challenged the proud and the legalistic religious leaders of the day. It called them back to a message of the Old Testament prophets who, like Jesus, taught that heartfelt obedience is more important than legalistic observance. And large crowds followed Jesus. He was the talk of the town, and everyone wanted to see him. And who else was in that mix? His disciples, right? They were the people that were identified with him, and so they were somebody. And Jesus gives direction there as well. I'd like to read verses 14 through 16 in Matthew chapter 5. Verse 14, ye are the light of the world. Who is ye? He's talking to the people that are gathered around him. Does it stop there? No, I believe it goes on and includes us today. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill can be hid. Is it an accurate reading? No. Cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and do what? And glorify your Father where? Which is in heaven. Ye are the light of the earth. The title of the message this morning is, Ye are the light of the world. God calls his followers to be a light to the world around. And we all know that the world's growing dark. Jesus said it would. But you know what is disappointing? And that's one thing that as you go back to meeting people you haven't seen in years, is there some disappointing? There's also things that disappoint you. You see candles that were once lit, thinking about people's lives that were on fire for Christ. There is no flame, or it's really flickering. And your heart feels burdened for those people because you wonder, at the trajectory that they are going, where will they be or where will their family be in even 25 years? In other words, to put it into plainer language, the walk you were walking is preaching a sermon louder than the words you speak. Your actions speak so loud, I can't hear a thing you're saying. And that's, we can try and argue that point all day long. That's the point. The life of an individual proclaims where his heart really is. A picture is worth a thousand words. So as somebody observes your life with their own two eyes, they can give you a pretty good illustration, and it gives them an indicator of where you are at spiritually in your life. Is it what you think they're seeing? Turn with me to Matthew chapter 7. This is towards the end of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. I'd like to read verses 17 through 29 and thinking about the fruit that people observe. What is it? In verse 17 of Matthew chapter 7, Jesus says this, even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. Simple point, but a profound point. A good tree will produce what? Good fruit. An evil tree will produce what? Bad fruit. Simple point, profound point. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. Neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them. Not every one that saith, Lord, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works. And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine, and does what? What I talk about, James said, a person that hears, but also that also does. Jesus says here, he says, therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man, which built his house upon a rock, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And every one that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man, which built his house upon the sand, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. And it came to pass, when Jesus had ended these sayings, that people were astonished at his doctrine. For he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes. If we want to live a life that is stable, if we want our life, our light to shine brightly, it needs to be built on the right foundation. And we'll get into our first point and talk about how our light is lit to begin with. It's an important point. But Jesus brings it out clearly back to our previous point of the fruit that people see. James talks about can a fountain bring forth bitter water and sweet water, fresh water or stale water? No. The same fountain can't bring forth both. I would like to look at four areas where we can be an effective light in the world. Number one, as an individual, as think of being a light, a city that is set on a hill. As people observe, what do they see? Do they see Christ? Number two is in the home. And number three is in the workplace. And number four is in the church. But I have a problem. I only got to point number one. I didn't have enough of time for point number two, point number three, or point number four, unless I brought lunch. And I didn't do that. So that will be for a later date, I guess, if the Lord leads that way. So the sermon this morning is simply, how can I, as an individual, show light to the world around? Because that's God's call to you and I. As people see you, see, that is a stark difference between, if you go back in Anabaptist history, of the vision and the burden, or the burden, I should say, is that as Christians, it needs to be more than Sunday talk. We talked about you come to church Sunday, and yeah, well, that's a good sermon. But boy, the preacher better get shut down on time, and that's why I cut it back to one point. I'll try and shut down on time. And then the rest of the week, I can live life the way I want to live life. Well, within some moral bounds, that's okay. Is that really what God wants of us? And so I'd like to look at just some practical points. You won't necessarily have anything new this morning. But how can I be a light to the world as an individual? Turn with me in John chapter 8. The first point I have is first of all, our candle needs to be lit by the true light. I'll read just a couple of verses from John chapter 1 while you turn there to John chapter 8. But in verse 7, it says, the same came for a witness to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of the light. He's talking about John the Baptist. To bear witness of that light, that was the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Talking about Jesus. Now, Jesus talks about this light here in John chapter 8, verse 12. It says, then spake Jesus again unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. It's the new birth. As my candle is lit, think of a candle that's sitting on a pedestal. It gives light to what? Those that are around. Can you hide it? Remember what Jesus said? Do people light a candle and then put a basket on top of it? Well, that's counterproductive. Why would you light it to begin with? Jesus says, I am the light of the world. We cannot give something we don't have. And Jesus says, the scripture brings it out clearly, that we of ourselves don't have that light. We have the Adamic nature. But as we accept Christ as our personal Savior, that flame is lit. And we can have that. We can shed that light to those around. Point number two is, and we already talked about this some, but I'd like just to touch on this point again. What is the fruit of your life? If you want to be an effective light, one must have the fruits of the Spirit. As the people observe you, as I go about my life tomorrow, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and when tough things come, what do they observe? Love, joy. Think of the fruits of the Spirit. You know, James brings this out. Actually, turn with me to James chapter 3. We can lay our eyes on it rather than me say it. James chapter 3 and verse 8. He's talking about the tongue here and the damage that it can do. It says, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Doth a fountain send forth the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine, figs? Can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh? Is mixed messaging an effective way of sharing light? No. Do you think we have any mixed messaging that happens sometimes? Unfortunately, yes. And we'll look at maybe a few of those. But James brings it out clearly. He says that there are the things of light and there are the things of darkness, and these two do not mix. They're like oil and water. The two don't go together. They will separate. This can play out in more than one area in my life. What are the words that come out of my mouth? Does the way I handle myself, the way I dress myself, the places I go, my work ethic, my attitude, my relationships, what do people see and hear coming from my life? Remember I said that your action speaks so loud I can't hear a thing you're saying? James says that good and bad do not come from the same fountain. Like, if you hold that thought, and we're going to move on to some of these other points, and I think if you let your mind go back to that point, it'll be a good basis. But think of some practical ways in how, as I go about life, and as people observe me, I say I'm a Christian. Do I act like one? Is that what they experience? Point number three is a light to the world in the way that I handle myself. You know, the way that you handle yourself says a lot about you. And there are people who specialize in analyzing a person's behavior. Why did they do what they did? And you get into the political realm, and there's a lot of that's getting done. The unsaid but said. By the actions. Maybe by... There's a lot of things that enter into that. The way I handle myself. And this is very prominent in higher social classes. It can communicate a friendliness as people are around you that they feel like they're on common ground. You know, I can identify with that person. Or it can be like, well, I don't know. There's just something about him that feels standoff. Like, maybe he's just a couple notches above me. Like, I just can't connect. And it's good for us if we face that, to step back and say, I wonder why. Howard talked about this last Sunday. Like, are there things in my life that are causing me that friction or that pushback? There's also other ways in thinking about how I handle myself. You know, when I crawl into a vehicle, that vehicle becomes under the ownership of who? me the driver, me, that's not proper English, is it? I the driver. I'm not an English teacher, but maybe it's not proper either, but as I drive the vehicle, okay? It's under my jurisdiction. Do I drive like a Christian? Do I drive impatiently? You know, that's one thing that I have noticed, and I'm a little embarrassed to even say it for myself, but since we have moved into Pennsylvania, my driving habits have shifted a little. Do you ever think about the amount of impatience that's around? I mean, I guess when you get into New York City, you have to be accustomed that when you hear horn honking, it's just another form of communication. That, you know, I'm here, you know, I would like to be there, but you didn't let me in there, but that's okay, I'll get the next one. But we face it. Like, do you think that, you know, I'm running 5 minutes late, and boy, I wish that person ahead of me would sure speed up, and so I'll hang on their tail, and I'm right back there, but on the front of my vehicle, there's a license plate that says Jesus saves. Do you think that's an effective way of communicating to the person ahead of me that, yeah, Jesus saves where? These are things I think we need to think about. Having spent a few years of my life driving, there's probably people here that put on more miles than I did. But that is something that has humored me at times, and times that have caused me to have to struggle with my attitude. The level of impatience. The level of not considerate. I need to be there, and I will get there. So if you want examples, I'll give an example. It's summertime. We're traveling as a family. I'm just using this as a hypothetical. I've seen this play out so many times in driving a truck. There has been signs all along saying that the right-hand lane is going to be closed, right? And so you get up there as a person, and as to drive defensively, you observe things like that. You try and get in the left-hand lane. Now sometimes things happen very quickly, and you find yourself in the right-hand lane, and the right-hand lane is going to be closed. And you try and get to a merge point. But you know, I am in a hurry. Everybody else is in my way. Guess what? I can run the right-hand lane all the way to the front, and I can get in line. Do you think you can go back and pass out tracks to everybody you just butted in front of? You'd have a difficult sell, to put it bluntly. But see, those are ways that as we go about life, we portray Christ to other people. It's the way I handle myself. I'm in my vehicle. What about when I go out to? Recently, I heard of a young man that got pulled over for doing 30 miles an hour over the speed limit. I was shocked. And so was the officer. The young man went to jail. And sometimes we chuckle at that and we say, oh, well, just a young man's moment. Really? Like, do you think in a moment like that, do you think that you are a candle that is set on a hill? That you're a light that's set on a hill? These are just practical things that we think about. Or we should think about. Be courteous as we interact with people, whether we're walking, whether we're driving a vehicle, that as people interact with us, they say, you know what? There is something different about that person. And there should be, because Christ is in the heart. Point number four, a light to the world in the way I talk, whether verbally or nonverbal. And nonverbal is to the idea of attitudes. And if you don't know what that is, if you have a family, you will be exposed to it very quickly. We all use a lot of words in a day's time, some more than others. Some people just, they're bubbly, they talk a lot, and that's fine. Others, not so much. And we've probably all been a part of conversations where the conversation is all about who? Me. About my agenda, what I've done, what my interests are, what I'm planning to do, what, you know, on and on and on. It's me. It's my world. And you leave from there and it's like, never even asked about what I'm facing. And granted, if they ask you what your day was like, tell them. That's part of communication. But do I see other people? Do I try enter into their world and understand, like, what are they talking about? Ask intelligent questions. Enter into the conversation and think, I wonder how that fit together, and ask the question. And you can have a very nice conversation that can flow into a lot of other things, and it also opens up opportunities for you and I to witness simply over life's experiences. Maybe it's surprises that came into their life, and you can point them to God. People forget what you say. This is not original with me. I think it was actually Brother Don, I believe, that gave to me, and this is on the front of my desk that I had written down a couple years ago. People forget what you say. People forget most of what you do, but they will always remember how you made them feel. And think about that. People forget what you say. People forget most of what you do, but they will always remember how you made them feel. And we probably can all identify with that in some way, because we are emotional people. We can't get away from that. The words I use. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, that we're not to swear. Don't swear at all, not by heaven, nor by earth. Let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay. Back to the point, can a fountain send forth sweet water and bitter water? Can't do that. Thinking of our attitude, what is an attitude? An attitude is a bodily posture showing mood, action, or manner, showing one's feelings or thoughts. You know, what happens when things go wrong? We will face disappointments in life. We face things that make life a little tough for us because of what other people maybe have done, their own mistake that cost us something. Maybe we had to give up something. And my attitude can ruin my day and the people that are around me. I said ruin their day, makes it difficult for them. As husbands, what happens if your wife, you know, the person that you thought would never, ever irritate you in life, maybe the very thing that attracted you to her becomes the very thing that irritates you. You know, she's a very bubbly person, and after church, you're ready to go home. But you know what? She's ready to talk a while. And that very thing that was the attraction that brought you together becomes an irritation. And that attitude can follow you the whole way home and last all day. Maybe for the wife, it's the same way. It can be vice versa both ways. An attitude. Maybe it's the coworker that gets on your nerves. You're like, wow, I wish I could just give him a piece of my mind because I'd feel better and I think he would do better. An attitude. My boss is being unrealistic with me. He's asking me not to use my phone while I'm on the job outside of emergencies. That's not fair. I mean, I have to communicate with my friends. Really? Whose time is it anyway? And who's giving you your paycheck? A light to the world in the way I talk, whether verbally or non-verbally. Point number 5, and this is probably the big one that some people are just going to set back and their eyes will glaze over and say, there goes the preacher again. Now if I can find it. A number of my pages for a reason. That's good, I did. Number 5, a light to the world in the way I dress. And right away, some people probably think, there he goes. What difference does it make in the way that I dress myself? Because after all, I'm a Christian. That person over here is a Christian. The way I dress communicates. Howard gave an illustration last Sunday about that. He's standing outside the Calgary airport, and the person that picked him up, do you think he would have recognized Howard if Howard was standing there in flat bottom, like skateboard shoes, washed jeans and a leather jacket, and a hat tipped off the side, even carrying his Bible? Do you think his person that picked him up, do you think they would have recognized him? I thought, well, I don't think that person's preaching for us this week. And moved right on down the line. The way that I dress communicates. You want to argue it? I say argue it. If you want to have discussion about it, just look at the fashion world. It is fashion everywhere. Dress has been important. It's not only 2026. It has always been. Why did the Babylonish garment take such an interest for making when God drew the line? God said, this is the battle line right here. Don't take anything of it. But he saw the Babylonish garment and he said, I coveted it. He had a strong desire for it and he took it. Dress has always been a form of communication. But it's also something that God has given direction to. And it's something that the church has faced pressure on for many years. And we have, and we see that in the Bible, because we have different of the writers giving admonition to that. We have Timothy. He wrote the words of exhortation in like manner also, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but with good works. Was he the only one? No, Peter. He also had some words of exhortation. Who's adorning? Let it not be that outward adorning, of plaiting the hair, and of wearing of gold, or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit. Is that the end of the verse? No. Which is in the sight of God, what? A great price. God values it. As God looks down, he says, you know what? That's something I value. To see somebody and the way that they attire themselves. In the Old Testament, God made it clear. Turn to me in Numbers chapter 15. This point just stood out to me. Maybe you've remembered this all along. Numbers chapter 15, and thinking about dress and the way that it communicates in our lives should be as a city that is set on a hill, as people observe us, they say, you know what? That's a Christian. But I think there's a foundational principle here that we need to pick up on. Numbers chapter 15, in verse 38. And this is when God gives direction as to the borders of blue that were to be on the garments of the children of Israel. In verse 38, he says, speak unto the children of Israel and bid them that they make fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a riband of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe. They may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord, and do them, and that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which ye use to go a-whoring, that ye may remember and do all my commandments, and be holy unto your God. I am the Lord your God. Let's read verse 41 yet. Which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God, I am the Lord your God. Let's read just a little bit of commentary from Matthew Henry, who writes this. They are ordered to make fringes upon the borders of their garments, which were to be memorandums to them of their duty, that they might not sin through forgetfulness. The sign appointed is a fringes of silk or thread or worsted, or the garment itself reveled at the bottom, and a blue ribbon bound on the top of it to keep it tight. The Jews, being a peculiar people, they were thus distinguished from their neighbors in their dress, as well as in their diet, and taught by such little instances of singularity not to be conformed to the way of the heathen in greater things. Thus likewise they proclaimed themselves Jews wherever they were, as those that were not ashamed of God and his law. These borders the Pharisees enlarged, that they might be thought more holy and devout than other people. The phylacteries were different things that were their own invention. The fringes were a divine institution. The intention of it was to remind them that they were a peculiar people. Many look upon their ornaments to feed their pride, but they must look upon these ornaments to waken their consciences to a sense of their duty, that their religion might constantly beset them, and that they might carry it about them as they did with their clothes, wherever they went. If they were tempted to sin, the fringe would be monitored to them not to break God's commandments. It was intended particularly to be a preservative from idolatry, that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes in your religious worship. Yet it may extend also to the whole conversation, for nothing is more contrary to God's honor and our own true interests than to walk in the way of our heart and in the sight of our eyes. For the imagination of the heart is evil, and so is the lust of the eyes. I guess what struck me is the last part of verse 39 and thinking about why God asked the children of Israel to put these fringes on their garments. It says, and do them, and that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which ye used to go a-whoring. Dress communicates. If I want to lift myself up, I can do it through dress. But I had to think about the parallels. God was telling the children of Israel, he says, I have brought you out of the land of Egypt. I have delivered you. I have called you as a special people. And I want you to be separate. I want you to be separate from the world. We see God bless them and how the nations around them took notice of God's intimate care for them. We also see what happened when they failed to follow God's commands and follow after their own heart and eyes. They became a mission field and faced God's judgment. But think, let's just parallel that to the New Testament. We're not in the Old Dispensation. We're in the New Testament. As New Testament believers, we have been called out. We are to be children of the light. We have been called out of bondage. We are to live a life that is separate, but also that is where we have the doctrine, it's a doctrinal thing, of separation and nonconformity. And as churches, we have made application in different churches. There are different churches that are represented here this morning that have drawn different lines in different places to say these are some practical applications that we will put in place to do what? To protect the doctrine. And when you begin to peel those away, the doctrine itself becomes at risk. And a person will say, well, I don't think that's the case. Can you argue with history? History has shown itself to repeat itself over and over again. When a person begins to follow their own heart and their own eyes, it goes one direction. But as children of God, as called out ones, there needs to be a separation. There will be a distinction between us and the world. Do we try and see how close we can get? And I guess that's the point that concerns me. As children of God, there needs to be a distinguish in the way that people see us, in the way that we dress. Is it our salvation? No, it is not. Peter admonishes, he says, but ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy people, a peculiar people, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in the time past were not a people, but now are the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against your soul. Having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Are you okay with being identified as a Christian? Or does that cause some hesitancy? I'd like to use one example. I think that's something that's pertinent to our day. You can do with it what you want. But one of the pressures that we face, I think, that are pressing in is this, we don't want to stand out. Okay? I have faced that myself. To be a peculiar people, to be somebody that's different in dress. And so as a PMC, was I here when these guidelines were put to place? No, I wasn't. But I have agreed to support them, and I believe that God's going to hold me accountable for that. But as a pilgrim, as a PMC congregation, one of the things that we have asked our people is that we would like to see a button-down shirt. Correct? And this is where things get icy, right? We like to see a button-down shirt, and we ask our people to not wear T-shirts. Now, if Brother Howard got up here, or I guess we could say Tuesday evening, Brother Anthony was here, but if Brother Howard got up here and said, you know what, Elm Street, we decided to make a change to our practice. We are going to begin allowing T-shirts to be worn for every day. There's probably a few people here that would say, whew, wow, where have they been? The preachers are way behind times. But you know what? Our battle line has only shifted. Because then it's going to be, can we have writing on them? Can it be all across the back? But when Howard got done with that announcement, he says, well, something else that we'd like to also ask of our congregation is that we would like to see that the plain suit is worn year-round. What would happen then? Is there value in the plain suit? Is there salvation in the plain suit? No. I think there's some value in it. And it would disappoint me to see it go, which I think we are already facing pressure on. And the reason I say it like this is, you know, there are big businesses that have dress codes for their employees. And they don't have, and they expect their employees to come underneath that umbrella. And their employees do that. Why? So, well, because of force, maybe. But also maybe they want to be a part of that business, to be identified with it. Are you okay to be identified with Christ and his church? Just because a person wears a T-shirt, does that mean it's wrong? No. I'm not saying that. But where I am saying that, I believe that we get into some difficult territory is when I say that I'm going to support a church of my choice and I do something other than that. Do you think that sends mixed messages to people that are looking on? And that's actually a subject we could look at that as thinking of the church and being a light to the world. I'll let that lay. In the area of dress, sometimes we wish, if we were honest, we wish at times in life we could be a little more autonomous than what we are. But there is something about, as we have brotherhood agreements, and we support them as a brotherhood, maybe I don't agree with everything, and that's okay. But it also brings a cohesion. It brings a togetherness as we as brothers fight in this spiritual battle. How shall men know that you're my disciples? By your love one for another. Actually, this is point number 60. Light to the world in the way that I treat other people. How shall men know that you're my disciples? John asked. By your love one for another. Treating other people with love and respect. We live in a fast-paced society. We all complain about that. But what do I do about it? Was Jesus ever in a hurry as he went about his ministry and the blind man was calling out to him and he says, Jesus, shh, quiet, don't talk to him. He's a busy man. Jesus had time for him. This thought popped in my mind. This isn't original with me either. But so often in life, we try and deal with things efficiently. When you deal with things, deal efficiently. When you deal with people, deal effectively. And thinking about interpersonal relationships, the people that I encounter, the people that are close to me, to take time to build that friendship, and that's something I want to do as well in my own life. Treating individuals as children of God. This is in the sense that all men are created in the image of God. One race is not above another. And James actually goes farther, and he says, to treat people with partiality is sin. He said, as a person shows up, and you say, oh, you sit here. You know, you sit in that seat that's a little higher up. Another person shows up, oh, you sit here in the footstool. James says, that's sin. And so we do well to think about that. Do I treat everyone with love and respect and without partiality? Simply showing patience when we wish things would move more quickly. Thinking about a way of treating other people. Well, in closing, what is the goal in all this? To be a Christian distinguishes one from the world. There will be a difference in the way of life and practice. As one follows the teachings of Christ, it will affect one's beliefs, one's manner of life. And this is the greatest sermon one can ever preach. It is a sermon in shoes. As people observe you in your work clothes, see you relate to the stresses and challenges that life bring your way, it is a real opportunity to being a light right here within our own communities. I'd like to close with a thought I mentioned at the beginning, and that is the fruit hanging on your tree and what you profess, is it sending mixed signals? How many of you read the paper that came in our mailbox, the Stars, Stripes, and Advice? Had a few. I'm going to give a summary in closing. I would encourage all of you, especially young people, read it. Stars, Stripes, and Advice. The writer wrote a story on, and I don't know if it's true or not, but it could easily have been true. There's a young man. His name is Austin. He's at a Walmart parking lot, and he's unfolding the accordion sunshade inside his pickup. The hot Texas sun is beating down, and it's turning the dark interior of his truck into an inferno. Printed with the familiar red, white, and blue of the American flag, the sunshade glittered in the warm rays. Austin used to feel a twinge of guilt at his patriotic shade, and the purchase of it had raised the eyebrows of his dad. But Austin felt he was old enough to make some of his own decisions. It wasn't his first pick, but his other two options that day were between the American flag and the butterflies. Feeling pastel butterflies much too girly for his work truck, he chose the flag version. He figured he could just put the metallic side out, so the questionable side would be in. But after a few weeks of fussing with his conscience and the sunshade, he grew lazy, and sometimes, like today, the stars and stripes sparkled on the wrong side. Hopping out of his truck, Austin smiles to a tall, rugged man striding his way, towering in cowboy boots and a matching hat. He was the image of an iconic American cowboy. Nodding at Austin, he glanced at his windshield. Nice sunshade, he drawled. I fought in Desert Storm, and the sight of Old Glory still warms my heart. Still warms my soldier's heart. Austin nodded again and stalled for an appropriate response. He sort of knew why, but the right words just weren't on his tongue. The Texan continued, "You know that song? I'm proud to be an American," he asked, and then launched into a solo. Austin nodded politely as a veteran rambled on. "Yes, sir, that always stirs the heart." He chuckled. Austin felt the man's cool eyes gazing straight through him as he surveyed him from the top to the bottom. "But you're a Mennonite, aren't you?" Austin, feeling like a silly bobblehead toy, nodded again. "So you wouldn't actually defend that flag, would you?" The Texan bully asked him. "No, sir," Austin replied, "not according to what we believe. I wouldn't." "I respect you folks in many ways," the talkative stranger said. "Y'all are hardworking and honest and don't look for trouble, but I don't agree with your anti-military position. So I suggest, son, that if you aren't going to fight for that flag, you get it out of your windshield. For a veteran, it's sending some pretty mixed signals. If you're going to flaunt them, you better defend them." Austin nodded sheepishly. "When I bought it, I had some doubts about what it might say," he said. "And apparently, the American flag says more than I thought. Sorry, sir, for disappointing you. I see your point, and thanks for setting me straight." The outspoken cowboy stuck out his hand and gave Austin a firm handshake. "I'm proud of you, son. Like I said, I don't agree with you all, but I'm glad you live up to your beliefs. Don't give any more mixed signals. It's too confusing to the rest of us." Austin replied, "With God's help, I won't." And I guess that resonated. That actually became a point of discussion around our supper table. What does the world see? The light that is setting on the hill, is it a clear beam? Or is there mixed signals Matthew 5, verse 14, ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and do what? And glorify your Father which is in heaven. This story was an instance that was with the American flag. But you know, it can be in a lot of other areas of life play out in that very exact same way, where it's sending some really mixed signals. So I challenge myself, and I challenge you. Let's be a light that is on a hill that is sending out a clear beam. God bless you. Let's kneel for prayer.